Get him.
To do this in matter of importance, I am an alcoholic, a member of the Look to This Day group at Jamestown, New York. My sobriety date is October 16, 1991, and my name is Stoney Jackson. I'm going to put this watch up here. This is for your benefit, not mine. Before we get going here, there's a few people I would like to thank. And I would like to thank Bill and the committee for asking me to do this thing here. It is always an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. Second person I would like to thank is my sponsor, David Kennedy Jr., who has been my sponsor since 1986, even before I was able to get sober for any length of time. You see, he's one of these responsible members of Alcoholics Anonymous who reached his hand out to me, even though I wasn't reaching my hand out to him, and told me he was going to be my sponsor. He left no doubt. He didn't want me to go picking and choosing the person who I thought should sponsor me. He told me he was my sponsor and has been my saving grace on more than one occasion. I still call him on a regular basis. And he has shown me spiritual principles, not from explanation, but from his actions. And he has loved me when I was unable to love myself. The other person I would like to thank is, I had a sponsor, his name was Jimmy Memo. And Jimmy sponsored me from 1975 until he got ill, right around 1985, 1986. And he said he just couldn't sponsor me anymore. There was too many health problems. And Jimmy's the one who took me through the steps. He took me through everything possible so that I'm able to stand up in front of you today. The other thing I would like to thank is the city of Atlanta for letting us throw this hell of a birthday party. Some of the people I've seen work this weekend, and I showed up yesterday in the afternoon, and they're still working hard today, and it's not the people who are the vendors. It's not so much the people who are taking the registrations and all that stuff. It's the guys I see emptying garbage cans, has brooms and little pans to sweep up our mess. The Atlanta police who are standing on every corner so that traffic is run halfway decent. And please, if you're going to tell them that I thank the Atlanta police, don't tell them it came from me. But the thing is, the real giants of AA are the people who aren't the ones standing in front. They're the ones who go unnoticed and yet make this thing possible for us to have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And those people I would like to thank. When I do this thing, I very seldom talk a lot about my drinking. Mainly because I was a blackout drinker. And I hear in a lot of meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous, people talk about blackouts and yet they can remember them. Now, I don't understand that. I started drinking relatively young in life. All of a sudden, I was 41 years old. What happened in between? I have no idea. I know it's documented somewhere. In fact, the best way to describe my drinking is before they asked me to leave the state of Florida, they called me incorrigible. Before they asked me to leave the state of Indiana, they called me reprehensible. Before they deported me from Canada, they called me an undesirable. If I had gotten arrested a couple more times in the state of New York, they would have considered me a career criminal. The state of North Carolina, because they don't know any big words, just told me to get the hell out. You see, I did not behave very well when I was drinking. And a lot of people, a lot of people in my life, including my family, say it's just something I was born with. And in fact, I was at a convention one time, and a guy came up to me afterwards and said, "Have you always been this way?" And I looked at him and said, "Been what way?" And he says, "Well," he says, "I heard your lead." He says, "I see how you act." He says, I can't see any difference between the way you were and the way you are now. And I looked at him and I said, well, that really isn't necessary. But I said, if I was the same person I was that I described while giving my lead, I said, I'd be drunk right now and I would have kicked your ass by now. But I went on to tell him, I said, you know, but I've had an attitude most of my life, and it was just one of those things, I don't know, maybe I do agree with them, that I was born with. But when I was 12 years old, I worked on a farm. I was raised in a foster home for most of my life growing up. And so I was, the only thing I remember about growing up is that I worked a lot and I went to school. That's it. That's pretty much all I remember. But I worked for about 3 or 4 different farmers growing up. And I remember when I was about 12 years old, I remember coming home from work and I saw a state cop's car sitting in our driveway. And I thought to myself, good, somebody else got their ass in trouble for a change. But the closer I got, I realized they were talking about me. And I stopped and I thought, geez, what did I do this time? Either I was causing that much trouble and couldn't remember, or I just couldn't remember. But when I got up to them and they were talking to my foster mother, they looked right at me and said, do you know why we're here? And I thought for a second and I said, no, I don't. They said, it's about Bradley's bike. And I said, oh, that. There was this kid in our town. He didn't have to work for a damn thing. His parents bought him everything. And one day he was the recipient of a beautiful brand new 12-speed bike. And he was bragging on it about 5 minutes longer than I thought he should have. Kind of upset me. So I told him, yeah, I know, it's about Brad's bike. And my foster mother looks at me and says, what happened? And I said, I threw the bike off the Casanova Creek Bridge. And she gave me one of those looks that told me that she was going to kill me just as soon as that cop pulled out of the driveway. Well, the cop looks back at me and he says, tell your mom why we're here. And she gave me another one of those looks and I said, Brad was riding the bike at the time. Now, it seems like since I was 12 years old, the crime has gotten a little bit worse and the repercussions have gotten, they got worse as well. And so I knew I was in trouble with alcohol from the very first moment I drank it. I just was. And I was sent to Alcoholics Anonymous at a very young age. It was almost unheard of for somebody my age to be mandated to Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, since about the late 60s, I had been mandated Alcoholics Anonymous right up until 1991. For almost 24 years, they thought Alcoholics Anonymous was my answer. Well, I didn't think it was. I didn't think my drinking was that bad. You see, it got to the point I was used to having my clothes put out to the curb. I was used to being thrown out of my house. I was used to being fired from a job. I was used to losing vehicles. I was used to going to jail. So I thought, my drinking isn't that bad. It just wasn't. But I remember on October 16th, 3 things happened. And I drank most of the time. I drank for over 18 years in the city of Buffalo. And I was a street drinker. And I remember on October 16th, I was right near a detox center. And I had more wine with me that day than I could have possibly drank. But the thing was, I couldn't hold it down. Now I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings about people talking about physical bottoms. And I have had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of those. Sometimes bad, sometimes not so bad. But towards the end of my drinking, it was hospitalization bad. But that day, my body had said, enough is enough. And I couldn't hold any of it down. You see, when I started drinking on Mother's Day of that year, I weighed about 196 pounds. When I was admitted to ECMC later on that day, I weighed 131 pounds, and my skin was gray. And as smart as I think I was, when your skin's gray, it means you're dying. It means you've gone past the cirrhosis stage, you're dying. And I didn't know that. The second thing that happened, I thought I was going crazy. I was emotionally spent. I thought this God was doing this to me. I thought he was doing it to me on purpose for all of the bad things that I had done in my life. And I felt that sense of loneliness that the book talks about that only an alcoholic feels. I felt that desperation, that sense of hopelessness and helplessness, that terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I felt that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, thinking I have control of this thing, going back out and realizing I have no control at all. The third thing that happened that day was I had a spiritual bottom. Because for years and years, people used to tell me, they said, Stoney, if you continue to do this, you're going to die. And I remember that morning, I thought, what a nice idea that would be for me to die today so that I don't have to go through this thing over and over and over again to just die today. You see, I got used to having the shakes every day. I got used to dry heaving every day. I was suffering from neuritis, which meant it was hard for me to walk without hurting. So it looked like I was drunk even before even having had a drink. So the three things that happened that day is I had a spiritual bottom, I had an emotional bottom, and I had a physical bottom all at the same time. And for whatever reason, I knew I was done. I didn't associate it with getting sober or not drinking. I just knew that I was done. It had come to the point that I've had enough. Well, needless to say, there was a counselor there who, in that detox center, who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had known me for years. And she said, if you don't get Stoney in here pretty soon, he's going to have seizures, he's going to go into DTs, and he's going to die. And so what they did, they admitted me to the detox center, realized how bad off I was, sent me to Erie County Medical Center, and it took 17 days for them to get me medically clear so that I could sit out with the rest of the people in that rehabilitation center. 17 days. I was hooked up to heart monitors. They hooked me up to all kinds of monitors. They had to feed me intravenously. They had to have me strapped down. They had to give me something for seizures and DTs. And they weren't sure if I was going to live through that. Neither did I, for that matter. But the thing was, I was able to get out of there. I was transported to a rehabilitation center for the next 30 days. In fact, I was there for longer than 30 because it took them a little while to get me admitted to a halfway house. You see, I had worn out my welcome in three different counties from being in different rehabilitation centers. And I remember this one rehabilitation center said, we do not want another failure. One thing nice about that, they said it right to my face. They didn't bother passing that information down from one person to the next. They said it right to me. And although it was disheartening, I'm glad they said it. But finally, there was this guy in Jamestown, New York, who said, we have a place. It's not the biggest place, not the most beautiful place, but it's a sober place. And if he can make it down here, we'd love to have him. And so I went down there, and I've been in the Jamestown, Lakewood area ever since. I own and operate a business now. Later on this year, my house will be paid for. Later on, probably in another couple of months, my truck will be paid for. Now, who would have thought that a wino off Chippewa Street in the city of Buffalo would be able to do something like that? Are there any newcomers here? Anybody relatively new? Right around a year, less than a year? The one thing I didn't understand when I first came in here, and if you're new here, I want to explain this to you. If you look at the people sitting right ahead of you, you look at the people sitting to each side of you, and no matter how well they're dressed, no matter what kind of car they drive, no matter how much money they make going to work on a daily basis, we all had to screw up to get here. We are not here because we are fine, upstanding, responsible, respectable members of the community. Something happened in our lives, just like it happened in yours and mine, that brought us to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm a firm believer that it was a higher power that has worked in my life since day one. And it's that same higher power Jimmy had to explain to me that you say a prayer to every single day to ask for help. That same power, doesn't matter what you call them, that same power that kept you alive for over 30 years of drinking and drugging to bring it to Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, that higher power had to work quite a bit in my life, because I did everything possible almost on a daily basis to not be here. And thank God that there was. And I mean that, thank God. One of the stories I do tell, in fact, on July 4th of 1976, I went to that same rehabilitation center, courtesy of the Buffalo Police Department. And I was admitted there, and until September 14th of 1978, I didn't drink. But because I didn't know any better, or just because my addiction was to that point, I was using more drugs than should have been humanly possible in order to not drink. And I justified that by saying the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I did that. Doesn't say anything in the big book about stop using drugs. It just says don't drink. Total abstinence. And I did that. But on September 14th of 1978, after over 2 years of not drinking, I had a wonderful idea. That in order to get off these drugs, maybe I should start drinking again. Made perfect sense to me. So after work that day, I stopped into a place we generally stopped in on a Friday night after getting paid. And I walked in, sat down at the bar, and I ordered a drink. Needless to say, I got drunk as hell that night. And I had to make it through Delaware Park, which meant that I had to go around trees and shrubs and gates and fences, go around S-curves, do all this stuff, trying to drive drunk through all of this. And I made it through Delaware Park. Needless to say, I ended up hitting Gate Circle, which sits right in front of Millard Fillmore Hospital on Delaware Avenue. Now I know a white person built Gate Circle. No respectable Indian would put a concrete fountain in the middle of a perfectly good straightaway. Just wouldn't happen. But I hit the curb around that fountain so hard that it got my car airborne, and I landed almost short, just about 6 feet short of hitting the center of that circle. And when the police came and the ambulance drivers came and they had to have some wreckers come and get me out of the truck, I had made it almost halfway through that windshield. And the only thing that stopped me was that piece of metal which holds the rearview mirror to the glass and that parted my hair for me and stopped me from going all the way through that windshield. Well, after they got me out of the truck and got me onto the... They wanted to put me on a stretcher. And I said, the hospital's right there. I can walk. Well, after a short group conscience meeting, they forced me onto the stretcher. Took me in, got me all sewed up, and I made a call. And I called up one of my bosses, and I said, I got myself into a slight predicament. I said, I need whatever bottle of booze you have at your house, and I need a ride home. And so they did that. But when I got home, my boss said, what we're going to do is we're going to stay the night and make sure you're all right, take you into the office tomorrow morning and make whatever decisions we have to make. And so we did that. I went to the office the next day, and courtesy of the Demerol that they had given me and the booze that I had been drinking, I was feeling no pain. But come about 4:30 that night, the guys who I work with started coming in, and they took one look at the car, took one look at the truck, and took one look at me, and they could not imagine me walking away from something like that. But they said, Stoney, the Ali Sphinx fight's on TV tonight. Why don't you come over and watch it with us? And I said, I'd love to, except I don't have a vehicle. So my boss says, take the company truck. Well, I thought that was a good idea. And I said, what do you want me to bring? They said, bring about 2 half gallons of good vodka and about 3 cases of beer should just about do us. I said, I can do that. Went, watched the Ali Sphinx fight, got drunker than hell, and ended up going towards South Buffalo when I lived on the west side. And I ended up taking off 2 utility poles and coming to rest against a concrete abutment that was holding up a sign to a bowling alley. Now, if I hadn't hit that abutment, I would have gone right straight through there, double plate glass doors, windows, and it probably hurt or killed anybody sitting at that bar. Now, this is 24 hours less than what I had just done the night before at Gate Circle. And I thought, case of bad luck. I said, I got to quit driving these company vehicles. They're trying to kill me. Not once did I think it was because of my drinking. Not once. And it didn't take long for me to lose everything, including my job, my house, my girlfriend, bank accounts, dignity, self-respect, hope, everything. And I ended up on Chippewa Street one more time, which is every major city has a Chippewa Street on it. It's where you can go and get it. If you have the money, you can get almost anything there. And so I lived on Chippewa Street for the next 13 years. I called it home. I remember one time I was on my way up to a place outside of Buffalo to speak, and my friend Barbara was with me, and she says, my God, why are we going out on a night like tonight? It's snowing and blowing. It can't possibly be that important. And I says, it's a speaking engagement. Of course it's important. I said, I've slept outside in worse weather than this. She said, well, what did you do when it really got bad? And I said, well, there's a double dumpster behind Dewey's Diner that had a lid on it. And I said, if you move the garbage around a little bit, you could kind of sit in there or lay in there. Garbage would keep you warm, and the lid would keep the snow on, keep you kind of warm. And that's what I did. That's after churches started locking their doors. I would go into various churches, sit down, have a drink of wine, maybe nod off for a little bit, come to, thanked whoever I needed to thank, walked out of the church, and it proceeded to go on like that. I remember one time I was coming out of an empty house, and I was coming towards Chippewa Street down the alleyway, and I was looking and feeling my best after dry heaving and trying to straighten out some clothes that I had been wearing that should have been changed about 3 weeks previous. And I came onto Chippewa Street, and I ran into this little lady, and she took one look at me, and she goes, oh my God. She goes, can I help you? And I looked down at her, and I said, yes, ma'am, you can. And I said, I'm not going to lie to you. I said, what I need right now is 2 quarts of Richard's Wild Irish Rose. And she said, what's that? And I said, it's wine. She goes, oh, well, I'll get you some wine. I said, no, ma'am, I appreciate the wine you're talking about. I know what kind of wine you're talking about. The wine I drink has absolutely no grapes in it. I said, but I would certainly appreciate 2 quarts of it. Well, she didn't quite know what that was and didn't really know what to ask for. So she reaches into her purse and she says, will a $20 bill help you? I'm a connoisseur at cheap wine. And at the time, Richard's Wild Irish Rose was selling for about 78 cents a pint. So a $20 bill came in real handy. And it went on like that for years and years and years. I remember the store people who owned stores on Chippewa Street, they would give me money because they didn't know what else to do for me. They would invite me in, they would fix me something to eat. And I would, as much as I wanted to eat it, I couldn't. And I said, I appreciate your hospitality, but I can't eat this. And so what they would do, they'd give me money for cab fare, bus fare, to get out to the nearest hospital and do something about my drinking. A few people even gave me money to go back down to the reservation to my own blood family. They would give me money for bus fare just to help me. Well, needless to say, I ended up going to the liquor store shortly after that. But the thing was, that's all they knew how to do. And so it went on like that, and it went on like that. And I remember I was mandated Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hate to say it, but most of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous in the Buffalo, Niagara Falls area gave up on me. They said that I would never, ever, ever get sober, that I was going to die drunk. And I'm not sure if people think that just because you come to a meeting a little under the weather that you've lost your sense of hearing. But they would make comments like that thinking I couldn't hear me. And a few times I was able to sit at the meeting for any length of time. And they would say something like that I wanted to drink more than I wanted to stay sober. You know, I remember asking Jimmy, I says, why do they say that to me? And he says, it's because they don't know about the obsession to drink. He says, you show me in any dictionary where the word obsession means want, and he says, I'll take it all back. He says, let's read the doctor's opinion. And so we did. And it talks about that what we suffer from is from an allergy. That after a while, drinking became the normal way of life for most alcoholics. That we could no longer differentiate the true from the false. That we feel those sense of restless, irritable, and discontent until we can once again experience that sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. That ease and comfort. That, ah. So when people used to ask me, why did you go out drinking this time? That's all I wanted to do. I wanted to feel normal one more time. And I did. Didn't last for very long, but that's all I was looking for. And Jimmy said, you know, one of these days you're going to get sober and you're going to feel that sense of ease and comfort coming to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I said, Jimmy, how long do I have to keep coming to these meetings? He said, until you actually want to be here. And I thought, God, you're sicker than I am. But Jimmy's one of those people who knew how to talk to me because he was a street drinker on Chippewa Street just like I was. And I didn't argue with Jimmy a lot. I didn't agree with some of the things he had to say, but I didn't argue with him. But I remember, Jimmy's one of those people who never asked me, do I want to go to a meeting? I made the mistake of telling him where I lived, and he'd show up at the door. He'd say, get into the truck. So I'd get into the truck. I'd say, where are we going? He'd say, none of your business. I said, are we going to eat afterwards? He said, you don't want to know that. You want to know who's footing the bill. So when we'd get to the meeting, he would say, take a couple of cups of coffee, take two donuts and sit in front. I'll be there in a minute. So I would take two cups of coffee, two donuts, and I would sit in front waiting on him. And after a while, I got sick of doing this because I was the only one sitting up there. And I said, Jimmy, why am I doing this? He said, Stoney, if you sat in the back of the room, he said, you would wait until somebody you didn't like to walk into that meeting and you would not hear anything for the rest of the meeting. That's why you sit in front. A few times, and when we went through the steps, Jimmy had to explain them to me in language I could understand. And he would say things like, Stoney, he says, the one good thing about beating your head up against a brick wall is that it feels so damn good when you stop. He says it's easier to get on your knees than to be brought to them. That it's better to eat crow when it's young and tender than when it's old and tough. I remember one time I was getting a little bit judgmental. I was getting a little bit self-righteous. And I was getting a little bit cynical of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Jimmy pulled me off to the side and he said, Stoney, he says it's been a hell of a journey from Chippewa Street to where you are right now. But he says it's only a short trip. Back. Please remember that. I remember on my 50th birthday party, he was invited and he showed up. He was talking to me and my friend Barbara, and he says, he looks at Barbara and he says, do you know why Stoney's got all the things he's got? And he says, I'm not talking about the business or the vehicles or money in the bank or the house. He says, I'm talking about a little bit of hope, a little bit of trust, a little bit of self-respect. Do you know he's got all that? And she looks at him and says, no, why? And he says, it's because he drank too damn much and he found a program that saved his life. Now, it's comments like that I depend on. It's comments like that I have always depended on. Another person I've had the opportunity to have in my life, I met her back in 1974. Mainly because I was sent to her because I had just gotten out of a correctional institution and I was mandated to talk to somebody from the Buffalo Area Council on Alcoholism, and so that's how I got to meet her. And her name was Rachel S. Now, Rachel's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember going to Rachel's house one day, and I didn't make it a habit of going to Rachel's house sick or hungover or drunk or any of that other stuff. But I was unable to do anything else this day. And she had me sit in the kitchen. She had me help her fix lunch. And she asked me if I could peel the carrots, and I said, sure. Now, either she knew I was shaking that bad and could peel a carrot in about 2 seconds, or she just wanted me to stick around so she could talk to me. You know, remember, she said to me, she said, Stoney, she goes, I'm going to love you whether you drink or whether you don't. She goes, I happen to like you a little bit better when you're not drinking. But she says, that has absolutely nothing to do with my love for you. And I know that's the truth. Because after I was able to get sober and she had moved to Florida and I go down to visit her almost on a yearly basis, she says, she goes, I still pray for you. She goes, I think you need more help now than you ever did while you were drinking. But she says, I still say a prayer for you every single day. But she says, I prayed for you until that day in 1991 when you actually got sober. Can you imagine somebody praying for me on a daily basis, hoping that I would live long enough to find out what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about? Every day for almost 18 years she prayed, waiting for an answer. That showed me patience, that showed me compassion, that showed me tolerance, that showed me love. And she did it just by her mere actions. And I remember, you know, I had gotten myself into several predicaments at Erie County Medical Center. And I remember the doctor up there who was in charge of the floor would call up either Rachel or Jimmy. And he'd say, we have Stoney up here one more time. But he says he's in really rough shape this time. And we don't know if he's going to make it or not. And he said to him, I don't know. He said, just from our conversations, I know that he does not want to die by himself. So if you could see your way clear, could you come up and spend whatever time he's got left and just let him know that he isn't by himself? And they did that for me. You see, those are the kind of people I had in my life. So many times I hear at Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, don't call me up when you're drunk. I don't care if people call me up when they're drinking. I'll tell you something, they're more truthful when they're drinking. I'll ask them a question, and although the answer might come out distorted, it's still the truth. But you get them sober for a couple of days, couple of hours, the truth seems to disappear. I remember Jimmy would leave me off, and he would leave me with a big book, and he'd say, I want you to read this section. Now, he didn't know it, or maybe he did. He used to drop me off at home. I would go to the liquor store, come back with a couple pints, a couple quarts, a couple whatever, bottles of wine, and I would drink the wine while I was reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would read certain passages, and I go, geez, where'd that come from? I wasn't there the last time I read this book. And I would think, wow, that applies to me. So I would read a little bit further, and I would identify with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But once I got sober, once I was able to stop drinking for any length of time, I would read that same passage, and I would say, yep, that applies to you, to you, to you, and to you. Didn't apply to me anymore. And even the book talks about that. Through every form of self-deception and experimentation, we will prove ourselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. And so every time I went back out, this isn't going to hurt me. I've made it back before. I just want to feel normal one more time. And it went on like that and continued to go on like that. Towards the end of my drinking, I was mandated to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could not sit in that meeting for the whole meeting without going to the bathroom at least 2 or 3 times to get a drink out of the wine I always carried with me. Always carried with me. And I remember this one lady, she would come up to me and she'd say, Stoney, she goes, we appreciate you coming to the meeting, but try not to breathe on anybody. And she was the same lady who taught me that hugging was okay in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because no matter what kind of shape, I came into that city court meeting, which meets on a Sunday morning in a courthouse, and I was a member there for quite a number of years. She would come up and give me one of the biggest hugs that I've ever had. And I'd look around to see who was looking. And then I'd look at her and say, Jesus, I am filthy. I smell bad. I can hardly stand up and you're giving me a hug. Well, needless to say, after I got sober in 91, she still gave me those hugs. And she cried every time she saw me. Cried. Except now there were tears of happiness, tears of joy. She showed me that it was okay to hug an Alcoholics Anonymous. She showed me that there was a compassion, that there was a love here. I was talking to a gentleman this morning, or maybe it was last night, who said he gets upset when a person who's been drinking comes to AA. How the hell did he get here? I am a firm believer that there should be an active drunk walking into every single meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at least once a month. And sit right in the middle of all you grateful people. To see who moves away. To see who whispers, somebody's drinking. Or heaven forbid, try to throw that person out. Because if you do that, it ceases to be a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It just does. I know if you come to our meeting on a Wednesday night, we meet every single Wednesday night on the corner of 5th and Church Street in Jamestown. It's a 7 o'clock meeting. It's a First Baptist Church. And what you're going to do is you're going to find out we're going to shake your hand and get you your first cup of coffee and welcome you to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thing is, if a person walks into our meeting who's been drinking, two or three of us will take that person out to the kitchen, possibly outside, maybe to a restaurant, and explain to this person what we have is 164 pages that explains to you how not only to stop drinking, but to how to stay stopped. You see, I am not so important that I have to stay at that meeting while a person sitting next to me drinking just so I can spout some kind of words of wisdom. I've never been that important, and I hope I never get to be that important, that the most important person is the person who's sitting right next to me who needs my help and needs it on a one-to-one basis. I'm not going to wait till after the meeting to tell them that. I'm not going to wait till after the meeting hoping somebody else will do it for me. When it says that when anyone, anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA. One of the very few times that word is used, I want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that, I am responsible. And not once in that responsibility clause does it talk about alcoholics. It says anyone, anywhere. So if a person walks into our meeting and says he's a drug addict, it's our responsibility to say, here's a meeting schedule for Narcotics Anonymous. We love having you at our meeting, but we don't think it's your place to stay here. You can be better off helped. It is our responsibility to help people, not judge them, not bitch about, well, we got addicts at our meeting. Do something about it. It's all right to bitch. Come up with a solution. And that's what happens at our meeting. If we get confused, I get confused, there's a number in the grapevine that tells me if you want to talk to somebody, call World Service, New York City. They'll give you an answer. And I've had to do that a couple of times, mainly because I didn't know. I'm not afraid to say I don't know now. I don't say it very loud or very often, but there's times I don't know. I just don't. But the thing is, you know, that person sitting next to me who's drinking at a meeting might be my sponsor someday. Did you ever think of that? I've gone to so many counseling meetings. I've been in counseling for years and years. And they would tell us in counseling that 7 out of every 10 people sitting in this room are not going to make it. They're going to get drunk or they're going to die. And I would sit around that counseling group and I'd say, yep, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yep, him, her too. 7 people. Not once did I point at me. Did you ever notice that? It's always the other person who's going to die from this thing. I even go into jails and institutions. I even go into mental institutions. And it's hard to find somebody to take people there to go with me. I remember this one guy asked me, he says, why do you think we can't get anybody to go? And I looked at him and said, I'll tell you something. Nobody in AA or most of the people in AA don't ever think they're going to be that bad. Ever. They can't identify with people who have wet brain. Who have drank themselves to the point that they stopped growing emotionally and mentally after that certain period of time. It's not going to happen. That's why it talks about and how it works. It says there are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if, there's that word, if they have the capacity to be honest. We read that every single meeting. What's it mean? Honest about what? Even Wilson wrote that when he talked about depression, that there could have been a whole chapter written, but he decided to stay away from that controversy. But the thing is, the honesty part of having a grave emotional and mental disorder is to realize that you will never, ever, ever be what psychologists and psychologists refer to as normal. Ever. That accepting the fact that I am never going to be like the general population. Ever. Now, if I can come to grips with that, I can fit right in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the book tells us, and even the 12 and 12 at the very end of step 2 tells us that we suffer from a mental illness. But we do recover. See, we have to find a new level of what normal is. When I first got sober, I remember I could not go home and visit my family. Because my sponsor told me, you have to stay away from wet people and wet places. And I tried to think, well, he's not talking about my family, he's talking about everybody else. He says, no, I'm talking about your family too, Stoney. And so I had to stay away. Now, they thought I was just being uppity or being whatever. But I said, I can't come. If I do, I'm not going to be able to stay for very long. He said, well, that's all right. Come and visit. Say hello. So I would do that, stay maybe 10, 15 minutes, and I'd say, I got to go. Nobody understood. People who are actively drinking don't understand that kind of stuff. They just don't. And so I had to come to grips with that. You see, I felt as uncomfortable around them as they felt uncomfortable being around me as a sober person. And sometimes I stay a little bit longer than other times. Sometimes I still feel uncomfortable. Sometimes I wonder, why did I go at all? But the thing is, I've accepted that fact and I move on. You see, I don't have to deal with my family group at a time. I can visit them just like I did my amends, person at a time. And they love having me. They just do. You see, just because my family still drinks and drugs doesn't mean I love them any less. And it took a while for that to happen too. I don't give up on new people either. I remember I used to call up Rachel or Jimmy. It'd be about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. See, I'm not one of them convenient drunks. I called them up when I was feeling that sense of hopelessness I don't know what to do. So I would call them up. They'd say, where are you? I'd say, I don't know. Let me find a street sign and I'll tell you. And so I'd find out where I was and they would come and give me. And I mean not just once in a while, I mean every time. And they would get me into the car and they would go, Stoney, what do you want to do? And I said, I don't know. They said, do you want to get sober? And I said, gee, I can't answer that. I said, let me finish this wine and I'll give you an answer. So I'd finish the wine and I'd say, well, I'm ready now. And they would take me to a hospital. They would take me to a detox center. They would take me to wherever they needed to take me to. They even took me home a couple of times to get me cleaned up. Try to give me something to eat. But they helped me every time. They didn't pass judgment on me. They didn't need to make themselves feel good at my expense. They loved me until I was able to love myself. And that's why I don't give up on new people. Mainly because a few people didn't give up on me. I will be eternally grateful for those people. Eternally grateful. I remember the one person who helped me the most, I think. She was a volunteer up to the Erie County Medical Center. Now, she was there when I first started going up there back in 1976 and was still there in 91. Now, she was about 90 years old back in 1976, so she was kind of old in 91. But I remember she was one of those people who would see me come in. And after I started coming to a little bit, I realized she was the person who put a cool, damp cloth on my forehead to make me feel a little bit better. She would hold my hand. And I remember the last time I was there, she asked two of the nurses to help me take a shower because I was unable to stand up and pretty much do it by myself. So she asked them to come in and help me do that. And they did. And even when I was able to go out and sit with the rest of the people at that rehabilitation center, she would sit next to me. And she would make sure that they only filled my coffee cup half full so I wouldn't burn myself. She would feed me with a tablespoon. Because I tried to help her and I would be shaking so bad that most of the food would fall off. And I remember every single time that I went to Erie County Medical Center, on my leaving, she would track me down and she would always catch me before going out the door. And she would hand me a piece of paper and she goes, Stoney, she goes, please read this. And usually my agenda was across the street down on your left-hand side a little bit, walking out of ECMC, which meant that there was a liquor store there, and that's where I usually went. So I never bothered to open up what she gave me, never bothered to read it. It either ended up in the waste paper basket or ended up on the nursing desk. But on that last day that I was there, I opened it up and I read it for the very first time. And it was called The Desiderata. Now, I had never seen this before, never read it before. But the last part of The Desiderata says, take kindly the counsel of the years, gracefully surrendering the things of youth. Nurture strength of spirit to shield you in sudden misfortune. But do not distress yourself with imaginings. Many fears are born of fatigue and loneliness. Beyond a wholesome discipline, be gentle with yourself. You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here. And whether or not it is clear to you, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive Him to be, and whatever your labors and aspirations in the noisy confusion of life, keep peace with your soul. With all its sham, drudgery, and broken dreams, it is still a beautiful world. Be careful. Strive to be happy. After I read that, I went back and I gave her a big hug and I kissed her on the cheek, and she started crying. But I try to read that as often as I can because it lets me know the things that I should be doing, the things that I should be thinking about. Because the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends on our constant thought of others. That the occasional act of kindness is not enough. That I have to be the Good Samaritan on a daily basis. I have to do that every day. That's why prayer is so important to me. Because I need to ask the Creator every single day to help me with this. To give me the things that I need just for today to be able to do the things that I need to do in service to you. I need to do that. I remember Jimmy told me one time when I first was getting sober. He said, what I want you to do for the first 90 days, he says, I want you to open up the book and read the third step prayer. And he says, and you get on your knees and you read it. And I want you to do it for 90 days. So I did. Didn't know why, but I did. And the thing was, when he first originally told me to do that, he said, Stoney, he says, I guarantee, he says, I promise you, your life will change if you do that for 90 days. So I did it for 90 days. And after 90 days, I went back to him and I said, Jimmy, my life sucks. It's gotten worse. And he looked at me and he says, Stoney, he says, I told you, promised you, your life would change. I didn't say it would get better. He said, your life will change. He says, tell you what. He says, when was the last time you had 90 days? Sober. Clean. At the same time. And he knew that the answer was never. Now, people think when I tell them that story, oh, gee, you did it because you were willing. You did it because of this. You did it. No, I didn't. I did it to prove that little guy wrong. I wanted to go back after 90 days and say, this is not working. I'd rather be drinking. But the thing was, my life was changing. People weren't actually crossing the street when they saw me coming. I was able to hold down a job. It took me 9 months after I quit drinking to be able to eat corn with a fork because my shakes had diminished to that point. 9 months. That was one of my first spiritual awakenings. Another one was being able to sleep the whole night through without waking up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning thinking I had some place to go. I remember when I first stopped drinking, I still remember the first time I laughed so hard I cried. And that's never happened in my life. I mean, me and somebody else were making fun of somebody else, and that's how it happened. But it's never happened before. I'd never laughed to that point. I just didn't see anything humorous about life at all. But like I said, I'm a firm believer in the power of prayer. And I sometimes tell a story about that, and it has to do with a little boy with a devil-may-care attitude. And he was the recipient of a brand new bike. And with his attitude, he needed to try this bike out. So he took it to the top of this big hill, started coming down it as fast as he could, hit a rock, went ass over teacup, and wrecked himself and the bike. And when he looked down and saw the condition the bike was in, he let loose with some of the worst four-letter words known to God and man. And while he was doing this, he looked up and there was a priest standing there. And the priest came over to the little boy and he says, son, he says, the next time anything bad like this happens to you again, he says, what I want you to do is bow your head, fold your hands, and say a prayer. And the little boy, because he didn't want to hear anything, just picked up his bike, took it home. About 3 or 4 days later, the bike was all fixed up. Damned if he didn't go up on that same hill. Started coming down it as fast as he could. Hit that same rock, went ass over teacup, and wrecked himself and the bike one more time. And right before he was going to let loose with some of these four-letter words, he looked up and there's that pesky priest again. And he says, oh, well, I might as well try it. So he bowed his head, he folded his hands, and he said a prayer. And all of a sudden, the rim of the bike formed itself into a perfect circle. The spokes straightened themselves out. Even the tire inflated itself. And that little boy looked down at that bike and says, "My God, prayer works." The priest looks down at the bike and says, "Son of a bitch." Now I can identify with that little boy and his attitude and his needing to try it over and over again just to see if things would be different. I can also identify with the priest because I did not think it was possible for me to be sober on a Saturday afternoon ever. It wasn't happening. It wasn't happening for me. And as much as you folks reached out to me, as much as you folks prayed for me, it just wasn't happening. I remember at one of our Jamestown anniversaries, I invited my friend Lloyd E. to come down and speak for us. And Lloyd used to come to the city court meeting, and he used to see me come in all shapes, coming off the streets of the city of Buffalo, knowing that I was a street drinker, knowing that I couldn't stop. And he would just look at his wife, Grace, and just shake his head, feel sad. He'd say a prayer for me. And he made the remark at that anniversary meeting. He says, "One day I saw Stoney come in. His hair was combed. He looked relatively clean. He was even walking vertical, which meant I wasn't drinking at all." And Grace looks at him and says, "What do you think happened?" And Lloyd's thought for a minute. And he says, "It's just Stoney's turn." That the Creator, for whatever reason, decided that enough was enough. I'd suffered enough. I'd caused myself enough harm. I'd caused everybody else enough harm. That enough was enough. And the Creator said, "It's your turn today." And He gave me all of the things necessary for me to make it through that day. And the next day. And the next day. And for the next over 23 years, every day. On March 1st of 1995, my brother Fritz passed away from a brain aneurysm courtesy of this disease. And in the process of getting my brother Fritz laid out in the Cattaraugus territory at my brother Junior's house, Fritz was a Vietnam vet. He passed away on Wednesday, but on Friday they were going to have a military service. And my brother Junior went out that Friday afternoon to move this big, gigantic wreath to let everybody know what the military service was going to be. And my brother Junior had a massive heart attack and passed away 20 minutes later. Two brothers in 2 days. And I thought, this is not right. And I remember Jimmy called me up and he says, "Stoney, how you doing?" And I said, "I am pissed right now." He says, "At God?" And I said, "Yep, Him too." And he says, "Are you talking?" He says, "Are you praying?" I said, "Jimmy," I says, you probably won't appreciate the words I'm using, but I am certainly talking." And he said, "Stoney," he says, "the words will clear themselves up. Keep praying." And I remember, I after each wake, I would go home and there would be food at my door. There would be cards in the mail. There would be messages on my answering machine. People would call me all during the night and say, "Stoney, if there's anything we can do for you, please let us know." And although the members of my group, a few members of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Jamestown area, although they didn't know my brothers, didn't know my family, they were there for both funerals just to let me know that Alcoholics Anonymous was there. And after everything was said and done, I remember Jimmy said, "I know it doesn't feel like it, but," he says, "I'm with you every step of the way." And I know that to be true. A lot of times people want to know why I get dressed up to do this kind of stuff. And I remember there was this guy, his name was Bill Tobico. He'd been sober since Christ was a corporal. But I remember I walked into a meeting in South Buffalo one day, just getting off of work. And I was getting ready to sit down, and Bill says, "Stoney, come here a minute." He pulled me off to the side. I said, "Bill, what can I do for you?" He says, "Stoney," he says, "everybody knows your work." He says, "Go home, take a shower, change clothes, and come back." He says, we waited for you for over 20 years. 15 minutes is not going to matter. See, it's people like that who are willing to reach out to help me, willing to explain things to me, didn't feel the need to try to embarrass me. They pulled me off to the side and just gave me a little bit of information so that I could fit into the very program that saved my life. There's a couple of things I do on a daily basis. I say the 3rd, 7th, and 11th step prayer on my knees. I try to read the Desiderata as often as I can. And I say another prayer, and it goes something like this. O Great Spirit, whose voice I hear in the winds, whose breath gives life to all the world, hear me. I come to you as one of your many children. I am small and weak. I need your strength and wisdom. Let me walk in beauty. Make my eyes clear that I may ever behold the red and purple sunset. Make my hands respect the things that you have made and my ears sharp that I may hear your voice. Grant me wisdom that I may learn the things you have taught my people, the lessons you have hidden in every leaf and rock. I seek strength not to be superior to my brothers, but that I may be able to fight my greatest enemy, myself. Make me always ready to come to you with clear eyes, clean hands, and a pure heart. For as life fades as the fading sunset, may my spirit come to you without shame. I say that every day because it lets me know that I am still a part of this circle of life and that the only way that I can continue to get better, continue to be of maximum service, is to keep coming here, keep being a part of you, and know in my heart that there is no other place that I would rather be right now than in Atlanta, Georgia, celebrating our 80th birthday. Because like Jimmy Memo says, you folks saved my life, and I came here this week to thank you for that from the very bottom of my heart. Thank you.